Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that eight-show-a-week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery. So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Joanna Murray-Smith's plays have been produced and translated all over the world, in over 24 languages, including on Broadway, the West End, and at the Royal National Theatre in London. Joanna has worked across many forms, from plays to novels, journalism, opera libretti, and screenplays. Her plays include Switzerland, Pennsylvania Avenue, Songs for Nobodies, The Gift, Rockabye, The Female of the Species, 90, Bombshells, Honor, and Berlin. Joanna is one of the country's most distinguished playwrights and a most wonderful conversationalist. It is indeed a delight to feature Joanna Murray-Smith in this insightful episode of the Stages podcast. It's a lovely spring day in Sydney, Joanna. What's it like in Melbourne?
It's beautiful. I'm sitting upstairs in my bedroom, which looks out onto a roof garden, which I have completely filled with roses because they're the only things that last in on a roof in Melbourne. They're so hardy, and it's just ablaze with colour and perfume. So very well positioned.
You are such a playwright. That was a beautiful description, an opening scene.
A chair, a door, a rose.
Yes, exactly. Who could ask for anything more? Joanna Murray-Smith, you delivered the keynote address at the 2015 Playwriting Australia National Play Festival. And I just wanted to read a section from that. I've been well-reviewed, badly reviewed, had good years and bad years, have vowed to end it all many times. But as I have often said, a writer needs only to have an ego that just narrowly outranks their vulnerability. Like most writers, I learnt the hard way, the truth of Kurt Vonnegut's wonderful description of the writing life. We have to continually be jumping off cliffs and developing our wings on the way down. Joanna, I would say that you've grown a most propellant set of wings that have allowed you to soar like an eagle and avoid jumping into the abyss. But does writing still feel like that?
Yes, absolutely. It still feels like that. The part that feels a little bit different is that probably about maybe 10 years ago, I started to realize or go through a transition of, and this will sound probably horrifying to your listeners, but a transition from thinking that my life as a writer was the definition of who I was on earth to feeling that who I was on earth was going to be defined by the quality of the relationships I had. And what that did was it didn't make me any less hungry to write or work any less hard, but it did make me feel as if it wasn't life and death. And I think before that, I had felt that. You know, I really did. There were moments as a younger writer where a disappointment happened. You know, for instance, Honor on Broadway, you know, it did fine, but it was expected to be an amazing hit, and it wasn't. It was pretty much the only production that wasn't very successful of that play. And I thought after that I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human. And I never feel like I'm quite on that precipice. But in terms of jumping into the unknown, and having to grow wings. Yes, I do feel like that still.
Indeed, after that Broadway production of Honor, you didn't write for about a year. What got you back on the horse?
An idea. I mean, it's pretty much as simple as that. If you have an idea that comes to you with, I guess, a certain amount of mystery around it and a certain amount of clarity around it, it becomes irresistible. So a central concept, which for me was the play Nightfall, where, and the concept was, would two parents admit to something they didn't do in order to see their daughter again? That was the core of the play. And it was a play, I suppose, about the power of words. Not that anyone really saw it that way. I saw it as a drama about parents being threatened by a daughter who had been gone for 7 years, who said she would only come back and see them if they admitted what they'd done. And they, well, if you believe them, they believe they did nothing. So they have to resolve whether they're going to admit to something false to satisfy the daughter's false memory, or whether the cost of that was too high. So that was a kind of, that had enough questions in the idea to make me really interested, because I suppose I felt I didn't know what I would do in that situation. And there was a lot of kind of interesting reading to do about the way memory worked and false memory. But there was also a clarity about it, which is that the stakes were irresistible. They were huge stakes. You know, the thought of not seeing your daughter again, but also the idea of confessing to something that was heinous. There were such fantastic kind of polar opposites. And as we know, all drama is conflict. And the idea of putting those two things on either side of my story just felt so irresistible, I couldn't not write it. And that, I think that's kind of where I realised that no matter how low I got, and I got very low in those days, that there was a part of me that was fundamentally irresistibly creative and very robust. And even though I felt at times as if I was fragmenting and falling apart and couldn't go on, I slowly over a number of years began to realize that there was always something inside me that was going to come to my rescue. And that was the power of an idea to enthrall me.
Playwriting is a solitary experience. It's not till the rehearsal room, perhaps, that you merge with other creatives. Do you get lonely when you're writing?
No. I don't. In fact, I get nervous about being around people when the time comes. I mean, what usually happens is there's a sort of transition period. That first day of rehearsals is probably the second most terrifying day in the life of a play. The most terrifying is the first preview, but it's pretty scary sitting around the table for the first time and hearing human beings be the voices that you've been living with inside your head. And it doesn't matter how experienced you become as a playwright, you can't really second guess what's going to happen on that first day of rehearsals. And you begin to realize, of course, the power of collaboration and also the false security of being alone. Because when you're alone, you can kind of persuade yourself that you're succeeding, because you can make those voices work when they're saying the dialogue inside your head. Your imagination has shifty ways of operating that makes you think what you're writing is perfection. And then you get around the table and you realize that when the words are flying out of heads through mouths into the open air, sentences change. They just change. Feelings can sound incredibly contrived once they're articulated out loud. There are stretches that seemed like, you know, that seemed to me like great pieces of writing, and then when I hear them around the rehearsal table, I realise that they're terribly overwritten, and, you know, they might belong in a bad novel, and they certainly don't belong in a good play. So that's always humbling, and also, of course, incredibly exciting when things start to work. The joy of that collaboration begins to take over, and there are all sorts of aspects to it. I mean, the wonder of seeing the set model for the first time, you know, that's always, unless it's bad, that's always such an ecstatic moment that your what began as just this little tiny idea, probably when you're daydreaming in bed or in the shower or going for a walk or whatever, there are now all of these highly competent, very well-trained people who are working at the top of their game, trying to translate that into a physical reality. And they usually are ingenious in the way that they do it. And there's just that moment of looking at those little models, and suddenly the whole play gets lift off.
It must be like giving one of your children away and entrusting them to other human beings to take care and nurture and build as you would like.
It is. And I mean, I suppose, yeah, the best analogy, I guess, is that you kind of hire the best nanny and nanny's assistants that you can, and hope that your baby is going to flourish with them. But ultimately, when you walk out the door, and I do walk out the door because I don't stick around for rehearsals, there may be times where those you have left your child in the care of are going to be better for your child than you are. And that is usually the case, that the director can see the play in a different way to the writer always, and in a much more theatrical way. So they're the ones who are actually in charge of lifting it off the page through usually their choice of actors, or, you know, our collaborative choice of actors. And often they see exactly where the problems are in the play in a way that I don't. And they are the ones who are going to draw my attention to the vulnerabilities of the play. That they, and there are always vulnerabilities where they'll say, this section here, we just get confused, or we lose interest, or there's a drop in energy. It feels overwritten, or it's repetitive. You're saying the same thing three different ways, half pages apart. Why are you circling back to that? All of those things I thought I'd sorted out in the writing process, and you never have sorted everything out. And the reminder when you are in rehearsals all the time, every second of the day, is this can't be something which works on the page. This is something that has to work in 3D. This is a theatrical form, and you may think that you're good at words, but theatre is more than words, and which is why when I'm talking to writing students, I always talk about silence. The silences are as important as the words are, and of course a good director understands that.
What sort of drafting process do you go through, and are there many drafts? Who do you get to read them?
Relentless drafts, relentless. Right. I mean, I read it, I can't remember which writer it was, but I read a writer the other day who said that they didn't think that you should number a draft unless you printed it out, which was an interesting concept, because I'll go back to a draft and I'll change four words and then I'll call it a new title. But actually, you know, there are only very slight differences to the previous draft. But probably I would say, in terms of after I feel I have a really good solid first draft, there would probably be another seven drafts after that where something substantial has changed, something that means you do have to print it out. You can't just make an amendment. I'll keep drafting as long as the director will allow me to. And that usually means as long as the actors are prepared to withstand change. And happily, most actors who enjoy working on contemporary drama, on new drama, not just contemporary, but, you know, new plays, they're the kind of bravest of all actors, because they know that in a way it's up to them to try and make this work a success. So they're very, very committed, and they usually become very invested in how the play is working and whether it's working. And so they're usually on board about having changes right up to the last moment, because they sort of go, oh, yeah, it would be so much better if that bit was right at the end and you took out the epilogue. You know? And so once they're on side with the mission, which is to create a great experience for the audience, from something unknown and untested, then they're usually pretty tolerant of changing it through all through. So the job doesn't really end. And then, of course, once it opens, I make a post-production draft, which is keeping everything that I liked about a production in a new script, but returning some of the things that this director made me take out that I think another director might be able to make work.
Well, what about the structure of your work? Because many of your plays, you write a dialogue between two characters. They're two-handers, and a lot of them do not have an interval. Do you think it's important to write in that one act? And does it offer you more to be able to just have two characters to discuss a particular theme?
Usually the idea comes packaged in the number of characters. So it's not so much me saying I like writing two people plays. I've also done quite a lot of one-person plays, and, you know, there's no real desire on my part to do that. It's really how the idea is going to be most powerfully explored. And sometimes I think in a play, if you have a lot of characters, occasionally the number of characters can dilute the energy of what's happening on stage. If it's like, you know, that the intensity of watching a singles match in tennis, it's a different intensity to watching a doubles match. It's a bit like that. And so sometimes what I'm really chasing is having the ball in the air all of the time with no one able to relax. And that is kind of very much a two-person scenario. But, you know, I mean, I was talking to the Melbourne Theatre Company this week about a play that has at least 8 characters, which I haven't written for a long time. And that's because the idea came to me with all of those characters intact within the idea. So it's not really a conscious choice. It's just where I end up.
A lot of contemporary plays seem to be written with sort of minimal characters, 4 or less, in the hope, the player hopes that it will be produced, because theatre is such an expensive business. So I love hearing that you've got an idea for an 8-character play, because, you know, you think of those great plays by Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller and also much playwrights before them, Shakespeare, who have bountiful characters. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I mean, of course, there is great excitement these days when you see a play which has a lot of characters. For that reason, theatre companies are so reluctant to take them on, unless I've noticed it's the artistic director who's directing them. If the artistic director of the company is directing, wants to direct a 24-person play, somehow weirdly it gets funded. You notice once you've got that theory, you get, you know, constant confirmation of it. You know, I always used to complain to Simon Phillips that he just always got everything he wanted for every production he did. It used to just drive me mad, whereas he'd say to me, oh, no, you know, you can't have, you know, another $15 for the budget, the wardrobe budget for your two-person play. Used to annoy me so much. But with my writing students, I am always trying to draw their attention to the practice by having your plays staged. Happily with theatre, unlike other media, you can get a group of friends to sit around your kitchen table and read your play, feed them dinner and give them a glass of wine, and they'll usually be happy to, which is, you know, a wonderful asset. But ultimately, I say to the students, if you want your plays to be staged, you really should not be looking at any more these days than six characters. You will literally double your chances by halving the number of your cast. Well, no, I mean, if you go to the National Theatre in London, of course, you see these, you know, I saw The Motive and The Cue, which is a play that was on at the National about Richard Burton and John Gielgud in rehearsal. And it was wonderfully entertaining, and it had a cast of thousands, and it was just so much fun seeing that many actors on stage, and it was very well written, so no one was ever sort of out of it. It was a highly energized experience on the stage and therefore for the audience, and that was just so delightful. I thought, well, this is really why now, if you love theatre, you go to London or New York, because it's your only opportunity to see those large-scale productions.
Well, you know, recently with Tom Stoppard's Leopoldstadt, which played London and Broadway, of course, it had something like 40 actors in it.
Yes, well, Tom Stoppard, I mean, you'd give him anything, wouldn't you? I mean, absolutely. He's still so gorgeous. He's like 110 now, and he's still kind of, I don't know, Mick Jagger to me.
Very much so, very much so. Well, which segues nicely into this question. Joanna, when your career was starting, there were very few female writers for the stage. I tried to think myself, and there's probably Dimphna Cusack and Oriel Gray and Dorothy Hewitt in Australia. So you may have idolised Tom Stoppard at that particular time. But as you were starting out, or even before that, who were the playwrights who inspired you?
Well, I was lucky enough to grow up in a house that was filled with writers and as many women writers as male writers. So just in my midst as a little girl, it never occurred to me that the world was weighted towards men. And it's been a great liberation for me. I think not just as a writer, but as a human, that I just never felt that very real and legitimate sense of being hard done by in terms of my gender. I think now when I look back that there was definitely an enormous amount of sexism around when I was first writing plays in the 80s and 90s in particular. And I definitely suffered as a result of that, but I didn't think I was. I didn't think I did. I wasn't feeling stymied or put down. With retrospect, I realised that the door was only half open. But at the time, I just thought, if I write well enough, I'll get somewhere. And I think that was because literally looking out of the big plate glass window of my parents' living room into this big bush garden that we had, and seeing in the garden Dorothy Hewitt and Christine Stead and these extraordinary women who had created their own worlds. I mean, Dorothy really created her own world on stage. And when I was old enough, I read her plays. And it wasn't so much the content, it was just the knowledge that it was a perfectly normal aspiration to be a woman playwright. I feel very guilty saying that because most writers have so much confidence to find and courage to find in order to even be able to visualize themselves having a writing life. But that was never difficult for me. I mean, in a way, it was much more difficult for me to imagine being a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse or a you know, all manner of other things. It was by far the easiest path. I mean, that said, I suppose if I had not had success by my mid-20s, I probably would have moved on, and who knows what I might have done. But I was, I guess, fairly by then, I was unsure about whether I was a good writer, but I was pretty sure that I was a writer. And just having that sense of certainty that that is your path in life was a great advantage, because it meant that when I had failures, I saw them as failures on the road to success rather than as judgments by which my life as a writer would live or die. Yeah, I mean, I guess Dorothy Hewett was probably the most important figure for me when I was young. But I never really wanted to be a playwright. I mean, I fell into playwriting. I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know what form. I was obsessed with storytelling and stories. My whole family was, and our house was filled with storytellers of one kind or another, whether visual artists or musicians or filmmakers or novelists or poets. It just seemed to me not that aspirational, whereas of course most of the students that I'm teaching are that the central question of their existence as young writers is, do I have the right to think of myself as a writer?
Joanna, in preparation for this conversation, I watched Berlin through the smartness of the MTC website, where it was digitally recorded and we can watch it online. And I must say, it's a magnificent play. I was watching it completely spellbound by it. And Charlotta, one of the characters in it, says, genetic inheritance is such a depressing concept, which really struck a chord and got me. I had to pause and think about that for a bit. And yes, that's quite a point. Do we all become our parents?
It's a terrible thought. I mean, it's more than depressing, you know. It can lead you to the darkest of impulses. The thought that your free will to rectify the sins of your parents rather than replicate them, you know, it's ghastly. And of course, once you have children, you begin to see that in action. And in fact, I was having a conversation about my poor mum, sorry mum, who's dead now, but she always, when I was a teenager, if I showed her something that I liked and she didn't like it, she would always just immediately, and she saw, I don't think she saw any malice within it, would just sort of say, how could you possibly like that? You know, it's ghastly. And it was such a terrible feeling as a teenager when she would do that. I so remember the humiliation of that I have had to really consciously not do that with my own daughter. So when my daughter says she likes something, I say it's fabulous, because it's the one, you know, there's probably three or four things that my mother used to do. She'd hold a grudge. You know, there are certain things that I have as a parent had to really consciously stop myself from replicating, because my instinct is to be my mother. And that of course was my, you know, the illustration of how you handle certain situations is the way your parents handle them. And sometimes you have to fight very hard against that. But in so many ways, she is in me and speaking through me. And I dare say that Lucy, my daughter, is going to be hearing my voice in her head as well. But that play, Berlin, you know, is about really the idea of free will in a way. It's about kind of where you draw a line between history and the present or the future. And the idea that we inherit guilt, which we do, whether we want to or whether we believe in it or not, We do inherit guilt, I think. We do inherit shame. And for these two young people in Berlin, the fundamental question is whether they can make time start again and not carry the ideological weight of both their historical family catastrophes. On Charlotte's side, the Nazis and the Nazi era and all of that. And, you know, and on his side, his sort of secular but nevertheless culturally Jewish past and family. And can these two people falling head over heels in love over one night be able to eradicate the demons of their pasts and free themselves? And it's a very difficult question. I mean, I think it's a question that most of us are dealing with these days almost on a daily basis, because colonialism as a concept is now such a forthright part of our social conversation. And, you know, whether it's the referendum or whether it's Israel and Palestine, you know, this feeling that do we take on positions because of our historical associations? Can we break free of those historical associations? Can we find some kind of neutrality? Or are we forever in some very, very profound way linked to something that is inherited and that we can't control?
Yes, like all good plays, it throws up many, many questions for us to ponder. We may not have the answers for them, but at least we are considering them and valuing our own perspectives and judgment. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I think, look, it's a very, when we were rehearsing Berlin, we had many conversations around the relevance of the play in terms of Australia and Indigenous history. You know, and in fact, I was talking to someone last week who said, my parents have a farm and one day I am going to be in a position of giving the land back to the original, you know, to the Indigenous people who had it. I'm on the left, I'm progressive, I'm, you know, fully there for welcome to country and all the rest of it. But when push comes to shove, am I prepared to give back the farmhouse that's been in my family for literally, in her case, five generations? No, she's not. But, you know, it does raise very, very pertinent questions. I think Berlin raises pertinent questions about many different situations where we have to wrestle with, you know, ideology and conscience and perhaps the importance of being able to find a, you know, moderate compromise. I mean, certainly in Berlin, I was on both sides of that argument. I believe that we should never forget the Holocaust. But I also understand Charlotte saying, what is the point of my generation feeling the guilt? Because that's not honouring the Jews who died in the Holocaust. You know, that's not what they would have wanted. You know, the whole point of the Jewish faith is the celebration of life and beauty and joy. And she makes a very forceful case in that way, I think. You know, but it's complicated, as of course it's incredibly complicated now politically.
Well, let's talk about something a little cheerier, other themes in your plays. The parent-child relationship, in particular the mother-daughter relationship, which we see certainly in Love Child and The Female of the Species, where the daughter is seeking an admission of love from the mother, who is pretty reticent to give that in Margot Mason's case and of course, Billy's mother in Love Child.
I think that the mother-child relationship plays really into the very strong feeling I have that who we become is very much influenced by the first 10 years of our lives. And I think our mothers and our fathers, really the damage that they do, as well as the gifts that they bestow, on us as humans has these things have repercussions on our lives right through. I feel myself, and I certainly know people close to me who had troubles in their early years, in their childhoods, who successfully really repressed the negative impact of that for decades and have now found in their 50s or 60s that those griefs from early childhood are taking a toll, that they've never been managed or understood or resolved. And I sort of feel as if those years just profoundly impact who we become and why we become what we do become, and also create a lot of havoc in our later lives. So I suppose I'm fascinated about my relationship with my mother, which was complex, as it was, I think, for my brother and sister. She was, an incredibly vibrant, incredibly intelligent, very smart, very vivacious and kind of stylish human being, I guess, with an insatiable appetite for knowledge and culture in pretty much all forms, and was an incredible sort of champion. But she was of her children, but she was also very, very complex and very conditional. So that whole concept, when people talk about, parents having unconditional love for their children, I never really believe it. I sort of feel that parents don't really have conditional. I think parental love is often full of conditions, that we show it when we're getting some kind of benefit back from our children, that they're pleasing us in some way, and subtly, often unconsciously, withhold that love when we're not getting what we want. And I think as a parent, you have to be very, very careful of that. Yes, of course, we love our children in good times and in bad, but we love them a little bit more in good times, maybe, when they're being what we want them to be.
There's tremendous recognition from audience also in seeing those relationships on stage, because no doubt they can identify elements that have happened in their own lives with their mother or parent.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I'm writing the screenplay for Honor at the moment. So, revisiting a very early play of mine and rewriting it for a different medium. And it's a very interesting process. But, as I've said before, at this stage of my life, I identify much more with the mother in that play, who is left by her husband for a younger woman, whereas when I wrote the play, I identified with a younger woman who was leading the husband astray. So it's been that's a play which has journeyed with me through life, and sadly, perhaps, is still a play with enormous relevance, it seems, because there are still productions of it going on all over the place. And yes, now a possible, a feature adaptation, who knows if it'll ever get made, but it's certainly been a very interesting experience to revisit something I wrote literally 30 years ago.
And it has been performed in over 36 countries, and it grew out of an experience you had in a writing program at Columbia University in New York. Was that an idea that you already had, or you were developed over there?
I had been commissioned to write a play for the Melbourne Theatre Company after Love Child. So Love Child, I think, was my second play at Playbox. My first play, Atlanta, was a failure. And that was, of course, an incredibly intense experience. Then I wrote Love Child, and Love Child was successful. And on the basis of that, Playbox rather wonderfully said, well, we'll commission you to write another play. They'd said, in fact, after Atlanta, that we believe in you as a writer, and we don't care whether the play is a success or not. So very few theatre companies will do that now. And really it's to their credit, I think, that I kept writing, because they were more or less saying we're in this for the long haul. And so I started, I thought of the idea before we went to New York, but I really wrote the play mostly at Columbia in the writing program, because we were doing a lot of writing exercises. I was being taught by a wonderful playwright called Eduardo Machado, and he had us do many writing exercises in class, which is why I do a lot of them now with students when I'm teaching. And I, every exercise that I did in class, I did with the characters I was working with in Honor. I knew I only had four characters: the husband, the wife, the woman who, the young woman that the husband falls in love with, and the couple's daughter, who's not much younger than the girlfriend. And so I just did different combinations of those characters in the writing exercises, and found that the feeling at Columbia, the excitement of being in that room with, you know, 15 or so other writers who were completely different kinds of writers to me and had completely different cultural backgrounds, some of whom I really liked, some of whom I did felt no affinity with, but all of us, no matter what, were struggling with the same challenges, which was how in an entertaining and valuable way. And of course, you could break that down into many, many different chapters of learning about structure and learning about dialogue and learning about character. But ultimately, we were all on the same mission. And the excitement of that, and some of the people I met who stayed good friends, was really the foundation on which Honor was written. I would race home, breastfeed my baby that my husband was looking after, sort of jiggling up and down as I was at Columbia, and write another scene. And the play was written very, very quickly. And then, you know, as it's, I've told many times, I went off to a writing group that I'd been invited to that met on Monday nights and read work. And Ray, my husband, had forced me to take along a draft of Honor, and the first draft of Honor. And whoever was supposed to read that night didn't show. And the leader of the group, who's a writer called John Patrick Shanley, that many listeners will know, wrote Doubt, amongst other plays, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, and Moonstruck, that wonderful film that Cher won an Oscar for. John Shanley said, well, who's got something? And no one had anything but me. So he said, well, let's read that. And we read it, and the next day he had spoken to a producer, and the producer rang me and said, I want to read that, and I want to read everything else you've ever written. And that was really the beginning of a lot. Not everything, but a lot.
Indeed, one of those first performances of Honor had quite a stellar cast performing it, didn't they? You want to talk about that?
Well, it was kind of lovely, because the director who I was working with at that point on the play was a director called Ulu Grosbard, who is a lovely, lovely director, now getting on quite a bit. And even then I thought of as an old man. And he knew everyone. And he said, well, I really think that the person to get to read Honor is Meryl Streep. And I was like, No, she's not right. Yeah, yes, okay. All right, I'll take Meryl Streep. And Meryl Streep, Sam Waterston, Kara Sedgwick, and another lovely actress called Frances Swift read that in that first reading. And it was, of course, it was a lovely way to hear the play read aloud in a big theatre with a lot of very important people. It was pretty terrifying. I met my possibly best friend that day, who was also was around, and she came up to me and she said, "You don't know me, but I just want to say, you know, I think the play is amazing and what a wonderful experience. And don't forget it. Just enjoy it." Many, many years later, we became sort of best friends. So it was such a lovely way to meet her. And then after that, the play was optioned for Broadway and it had a different cast because Meryl didn't want to do theatre. Really, because the play was on Broadway, so few straight plays get to Broadway, contemporary new plays get to Broadway, that whenever one does, almost every theatre company, significant main stage theatre company in the world reads it. And so as a result of that, the play has had an ongoing life, because even though that production was not the most successful production, enough companies liked the play and felt that they could do it. And I mean, again, that's probably because it's a very, very simple play to stage and very inexpensive. And also a totally universal story. It worked as well in, sadly, the story of a man leaving his wife for a younger woman works as well in Seoul or Tokyo as it does in Copenhagen or Edinburgh. So the play had a very human core to it that didn't feel at all parochial. And that meant that it could keep having an international life.
Speaking of those international productions, of course, many of your plays have had their words spoken by great Australian actors, but, you know, those overseas productions, Eileen Atkins, Annette Bening, Diana Rigg, that must be a thrill to have those women say your words.
Well, look, it is absolutely a thrill. And the thing is, you know, writers can be very arrogant. You can have incredible people in front of you, and there's just some really peevish voice in your head saying they're an incredible actor, but they're not right for the play. And you know, it's always a quandary when someone says, "We want Diana Rigg for your play," and you really go through, even though from a practical point of view, you just immediately want to say, "Well, yes, of course, because it's going to sell tickets and she's a great star and I've admired her forever." But you also know that your play is going to live or die by the quality of the casting. And if the casting's not right, it doesn't matter how good the actor is. And this happened to me actually in Los Angeles when Switzerland, which had been enormously successful at the Opera House, and subsequently in Melbourne and also, you know, has gone on for many productions around the world and is continuing to, and it's about to be made into a film, that Laura Linney played Patricia Highsmith. And now Laura, I think, is one of the greatest actors in the world. I think she's just a sublime actress, and I've worked with her before. She was in that first production of Honor on Broadway. But my desire to have an actor not just of that caliber but also of that prestige won the day. And in the end, the production was criticized for the fact that she was too young for the role, which she was. So, you know, casting is such a complicated thing. It's not just about the thrill of having the stars. It's the real thrill is when you have the actor who is perfect for the part. And I mean, look, to be honest, that was the case with Eileen Atkins in Honor in particular, and also in Female of the Species. She was great, but she was just incredible in Honor. She was so wonderful at the National. And Annette Bening, well, you know, I think Annette Bening just is just so astonishing an actress. And there's pretty much nothing that I write that I can't see her in. And she was so funny and so brilliant in Female of the Species. And then she did a reading of Switzerland for me, which she was absolutely fantastic for as well. So I've been incredibly blessed with the caliber of the actors. It's just, it's an incredible privilege to have had the opportunity to work with them.
Joanna, tell me about crafting a bespoke vehicle for a particular talent, which you've done for Caroline O'Connor and Bernadette Robinson in shows like Bombshells and Songs for Nobodies, Pennsylvania Avenue. How does that process take flight? You're given the idea. Do you come up with the idea?
In Songs for Nobodies was really dictated by Bernadette's talents as Simon Phillips and I saw them. And her really formidable talent was being able to sing like other people, that simple. She wasn't an actress. And so the idea for that was, it was a stage-by-stage thing. I wrote a monologue for her where she had to act in a genuinely, actorly way as a character of my creation. She also had to act as a very, very well-known person that everybody is familiar with, the way that they speak and the way that they move and the way that they sing. Now, the singing was no problem for her, but the acting part was a challenge for her. So I wrote one and she was brilliant. And Simon and I were astonished by that, that she was able within the confines of a 20-minute monologue to pull it off. And she really did pull it off. So then I wrote a second one and she did the same thing, totally different characters, different singers. So her singing, we always knew was going to be part of the equation, but it was my idea, because I didn't want to write a show about stars, because I felt as if there were already so many shows about those people, already shows about Garland, already shows about Patsy Cline, etc. I wanted to have something which gave me free rein to do what I wanted to do. I had to introduce characters that didn't exist prior to my invention. And so there the idea was born of what happens when a famous person meets an ordinary woman on one night of their lives, and what is triggered by that. So that's how that play came about. And full credit to Bernadette that she was able to spread her wings theatrically and embrace the challenges of really having to act very powerfully, as well as do what comes very naturally to her, which is sing. And in Bombshells, it wasn't too different. I think possibly it was Simon who said, let's see her play a range of characters. And, of course, Caroline is so astonishingly gifted in so many ways that was just such a gift for a writer, because you could do anything with Caroline. You can have serious material. You can have absolute out and out comedy. You can have singing. You can have dancing. You can have the lot. So in a way, the play was dictated by that. Let's showcase what Caroline can do. And then the common theme to all of them was, I'm not even sure whether it was intentional or whether it was applied retrospectively, but it was probably just a reflection of me, which is women on the edge of a nervous breakdown, which came very, very easily to me and seemed to be the common link, weirdly. It's always pleasurable writing specifically for an actor, because you know that you can avoid their less powerful aspects and play to their most wondrous ones. So that was definitely the case with those two shows.
Yes, speaking of on the verge of a mental breakdown, I mean, there's a character called Meryl Louise Davenport in that show, and I've got a quote here from her. Mental note, mustn't accidentally kill the children. I'm a mess. They've got my genes. I will fuck them up.
Pure autobiography. Never was there a more verbatim a piece of dialogue that went straight from my brain onto the stage as that.
I'm going to quote Anton Chekhov now. He said, if in the first act you have hung a pistol on the wall, then in the following one it should be fired. Otherwise, don't put it there. Now, you use a gun in The Female of the Species. which is a wonderful device to contribute to the farce that is that play. How was it writing a farce? Because again, that was stylistically, that was very different to what you'd written before.
Oh, it was incredible fun. I mean, most plays are fun to write, but that play was probably one of the most fun because I felt as if I had a very reliable structure from the beginning, which was to respond to the child in me who used to be taken to the theatre and, you know, after seeing the action on stage for 10, 15 minutes would just desperately long for a new character to walk on stage to liven things up, you know, someone, another human to look at, another outfit. And so I really that play was based around that idea of a new character coming in every kind of 10, 15 minutes into that play and creating more havoc and more chaos. And also I loved the character of Margot Mason. I mean, she's one of my favorite characters. She's a nightmare, but she's also lovable in her own way. And she's a great irascible provocateur. And I do genuinely think that we need more people like that, people who just throw hand grenades in of ideas into our society and say, okay, I realize this is controversial, but let's talk about this. And of course, the really great feminists of the 70s did that. You know, people thought she was Germaine Greer. She wasn't Germaine Greer to me, but if people, including Germaine, wanted to think that, well, there's nothing I can really do about that. But there were definitely aspects of her that were like Germaine, because they were also like Gloria Steinem and so many of the other feminists of that era, incredibly charismatic, incredibly stubborn, incredibly confident, bright thinkers who were able to stir society up in a way that made society listen. Even if it made them angry, they listened. And so I believed in that character, but I also knew that I could have enormous fun with her. So, and I also loved the idea of what happens when, you know, the mother is being held captive by a crazed young woman and the daughter ends up siding with the kidnapper and not with her mother. I also related to that. As I'm sure my daughter would. I don't think she's ever seen.
Writing that play, did you set out to make feminism funny? I read that was a challenge of yours.
Yeah, it was really. I mean, I'd spent a lot of time on campus in the 1980s where feminism was really subject of obnoxious earnestness, I would say. And the idea was that any kind of analysis of it had to be pretty uncritical, very high-minded and esoteric. And it was, I thought, on the danger of alienating a lot of women, you know, that a lot of women were saying, I don't call myself a feminist. And I was thinking, well, all women should be feminists. I mean, you know, what's the controversy in wanting equality? I mean, or the same pay or the, you know, or more choice. Why are women being put off from it? Well, they were being put off from it because there were a kind of strident group of hardliners who made them feel that if they wore lipstick, they were betraying the cause. And I really hated that. So I did, I think, wanted to poke fun at feminism in a way of sort of getting revenge on those years at university and those feminists who were so po-faced and also who gave me a very hard time because I was saying, you could be a feminist and dress up in suspenders and high heels and look like a Helmut Newton photograph. You can be a feminist if you're a mother with six babies. You don't have to be, you know, a lefty cool cat on a university campus to be a real feminist.
Indeed, Margot says at one stage, I feel like grabbing young women and shaking them. Get out there and find a revolution. Cry, scream, agitate.
Yeah, Well, I mean, there's a lot of, there was a lot of worth to what she's saying, you know, that, and a lot of truth to it, because if women, as we've found, if women don't take an active role in their own emancipation, wouldn't have happened if women didn't say, I'm not going to take this anymore. That women, and, you know, in Julia, writing Julia, the play about Julia Gillard, it's the same thing. You know, Julia stood up at a certain point and said, I'm not going to take this anymore. Well, no man is going to hand that to you on a plate. So Margot's right in saying, participate as a responsible defender of your own freedoms. And I think that's an important thing.
Do you read reviews?
No. But I get the gist from my husband, because I want to know if every review says the play is terrible, I need to know that. I mean, that really hasn't happened for a long time, touch wood. But you know, I sort of feel that if there are salient points, then I should know them. But that's very rare. I mean, mostly in Australia in particular, not always, but mostly I've just had people who just don't like my work or just don't like me. I really do believe that, and I think that there are certain critics who just don't like me. I mean, I don't know, they have an idea in their head of who I am, and maybe it is me, maybe it's something else. Unfortunately, their job is to fill column inches, and there's not much I can do about that. But I stopped reading reviews. I started out reading everything, but I stopped reading them when I found that they had a practical role in stopping me from writing. So if I felt that if I read a review and it was going to be nasty or unjustified, then I might feel that I sort of couldn't go back to writing until I was over the pain of that. And sometimes that could be a few weeks. And that began to really disrupt my working life. And so it was a sort of matter of self-preservation as well as income preservation, I guess, that made me feel that I couldn't give them that much power over me. And it wasn't, it's not a rational thing, you know, it's sort of like, you know, how the cliche is that 99 people in the room can say your play is wonderful and one not, and they're the only one, that's the only voice you go to bed listening to. Well, it's a cliche for a reason. It's so true. It's that which dismantles your confidence. And I began to think whether the value of the reviewer was equal to the effect of the review. And I didn't think that was the case in Australia, at least. I didn't think the critics were good enough for me to suffer. You know, sometimes I just thought they were just bitchy. And I thought, well, that's not going to, I'm not going to be able to discount it. It will upset me. It will always upset me. I mean, maybe I'm too thin-skinned, but
well, you know, it's
thin-skinned is also what makes you a writer.
Well, I was going to say, it's okay for, you know, people to say, well, if you're going to put yourself out there, you've got to be thick-skinned. But that's why you are successful as a writer. I mean, all artists have to be vulnerable, don't they? So why grow that thick hide when you know you still have to feel and express yourself on the page, those emotions that you feel. So, oh yes,
exactly.
Yes. You're wonderful. You're wonderful, as many audiences prove time and time again, and theatre companies. It's so great to see you being produced more in Sydney in recent years as well, you know, and in particular finding a home there at the wonderful Ensemble Theatre in Kirribilli, who are doing a lot of your work, including next year we're going to see Switzerland and an adaptation of Uncle Vanya.
Yes, I'm thrilled about that. Absolutely thrilled to be there. And it's such a beautiful little theatre. I mean, is there a more exquisitely positioned theatre anywhere in the world than that theatre? And I love that it's in a kind of residential neighbourhood and people can just walk out of their houses and walk down the street and be in the theatre without dealing with, you know, car parking and traffic and all of that. It's just such a pretty little gem. So it's always pleasurable to be there. I think they do great work. So I'm very happy about that. I'm thrilled Julia's coming back to the Opera House, and also to Melbourne and to Adelaide and possibly Canberra. So next year is a good year. But Peter, what's going to happen the year after that? That's the problem.
Oh, really? So you look that far ahead. Right. And Rockabye is being done in Canada next year too.
Yes. Yes. I'm really, really happy about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me finish with one more quote spoken by yourself. I'm very driven, as my father was. I feel as if there's never enough time. One life is not enough to write everything I want to write. So there's more to come.
Well, without promising anything, the only thing I can say is that I never feel as if I've run out. And I think, I hope, I trust that if you're engaged with life and you're engaged with people, and you know, the nice thing about having three now adult children, alas, still at home, but not all of them, but they're very much part of the household one way or the other, whether they're sleeping here or not. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, but they bring an enormous number of people into the house. And there's always something going on here, and through teaching and through friendships and through traveling, life is just constantly wondrous. I mean, it's terrible and it's grotesque and it's baffling and it's incredibly hard to deal with sometimes, but it's also just so wondrous and so full of amazing questions and incredible people and different worlds. And I sort of feel as if there's always something new to discover.
Wonderful. Thanks, Jo.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks so much. And apologies again about yesterday. It was lovely talking to you.
2024 will be another exciting year for Joanna Murray-Smith, with several productions playing around the country. You can catch Switzerland and Uncle Vanya at the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney. Uncle Vanya, of course, an adaptation from the play by Anton Chekhov. Switzerland plays May 3rd to June 8th, and Uncle Vanya from July 26th to August 31st. And also a national tour around the country of Julia, starring Justine Clarke. And you can catch that in Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide. Look at the handy net to find out where and when. Thanks for joining us in this episode. It's always terrific to have your company. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.